Today at Reader's Corner, Nancy Kane, author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Most people are familiar with the phrase, a born leader, but are leaders truly born? In her book, Forged in Crisis, historian Nancy Kane makes a convincing case that the roots of leadership are not simply a matter of birthright. Rather, effective leaders are forged through their ability to confront adversity, see the humanity in others, and make difficult choices. To illustrate her point, Dr. Kane walks us through the lives and crises faced by five leaders throughout history. While they lived in different times and confronted different challenges, this disparate group also shared some commonalities that enabled them to become extraordinary leaders, as Dr. Kane explains in the book. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. She has coached leaders from many organizations and speaks frequently at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the Aspen Ideas Festival, and the World Business Forum. She joins us today by phone for this interview. Nancy Kane, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Let's start with the Harvard Business School. When I think of a business school, I think of finance, accounting, strategy, management, usually taught by business professors. So it's very impressive indeed that the Harvard Business School engages an historian. How is your expertise utilized there?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm definitely an odd duck here because most people don't come to business school to learn history. But I've been here a long, long time. Been here 25 years. And I have taught a number of courses that are history courses, from American business history to the history of leadership, which surveys 26 leaders across disciplines and time periods and countries, to political economy, to entrepreneurship. So I've worn my historian's cap in lots of different areas, some functional, some much more pragmatic than others. But in all instances, because we're a business school, as a seedbed or foundation to help students and executives make smart choices, make wise decisions, become effective leaders.
So these days, employers around here anyway, at Boise State, I don't think it's much difference nationally from what I've read, seem to be focused more and more on narrower and narrower credentials for our graduates. Any thoughts on the strength that the humanities and the social science majors bring to the workplace?
So I think it's, again, another trenchant question, but I think that we are, as our moment gets more and more technological, and in many, many ways, the technology and the rise and increasing importance of biosciences and other aspects of, if you will, right, the left side of our brains and our ways of thinking and acting in more and more quantitative and transactional and technologically driven ways increase, the importance of the humanities actually grows, because the humanities, from history to literature to anthropology to religious studies and many other fields, right? What do these fields do? They help us understand not only the great questions that have animated, right, thought and literature and art and enterprise and organizations throughout the ages. They help us understand how we relate in all kinds of spheres by virtue of what is similar and shared among peoples across countries and time periods and different activity. And so, amazingly, you know, I think the humanities, which are getting less and less attention in terms of how we're teaching them and how we're talking about them, how we're drawing on them, are actually growing and growing in importance. And I've heard many business leaders over the last 10 years talk about this and bemoan, to the implication in your question, Bob, the increasing narrowness of what we're focusing on as educators.
Well, you certainly have a list of endorsements that's some of the most impressive I've ever seen. And by the way, I might point out that I don't think I'd even be doing this interview were it not for a CEO who truly values your work and who I think you know personally. Walter Robb is a professor of practice here at Boise State, and he brought your book to Boise State for the purpose of meeting some students and discussing leadership with them. And he threw the book on the desk and said, this is what you have to read. Now, of course, you know, Joseph Ellis, the great biographer, weighed in on your book. Howard Schultz has a very moving tribute to your book, as does David Gergen, Angela Duckworth of Grit fame, Michael Bloomberg. I mean, you've chosen these five leaders, and it just leads me to ask the question, was there a sixth you had to leave out?
Oh, yeah, there were six and seven and eight. So some of the people that left that didn't make it off the cutting room floor, mostly because I just couldn't write a longer book. I was taxing. I was indulging myself in presuming too much of readers in an attention, starved age. People that didn't make it off the cutting room floor but could have were Katharine Graham, because I have been teaching for years before the Spielberg movie. I've been teaching a case based on her memoir, Personal Story, on her decision with her colleagues at the Post to publish the Pentagon Papers in 1973, and just how she emerged, how she forged herself into such an important leader of this newspaper and helped forge the institution into such an important enterprise. And then Nelson Mandela, who, that's an extraordinary story, again, about a leader forging himself into someone stronger, better, more luminous, more effective. And then possibly, and this is probably the least surprising of the three, Winston Churchill, whom I know a great deal about, and whose emotional experience as prime minister and before is so very relatable, so very interesting, and so very much at odds with our first blush when we think about the man with the cigar and the victory sign with his first two fingers. Because, as you know, Bob, the book is really about the emotional experience of being a leader in great crisis and how leaders make themselves better in the moment when the waves are very high and the winds are very strong.
So this book was 10 years in the making, according to your mention of that in the acknowledgments, and yet its timing is precise and most interesting. And I think the subtitle of your book, as a matter of fact, refers to the power of courageous leadership in turbulent times. Could you address how this book fits into today's world?
You bet. So I didn't set up the timing. The universe, the book was supposed to come out a couple of years earlier, and I just couldn't finish it the way, at a level I wanted to. It just needed a lot more trimming and editing and just crafting. So the book came out in the fall this year, in a moment when I think American polity, our country faces a real leadership crisis at the very top of the nation in terms of politicians across the political spectrum, in terms of these people showing up and making decisions as courageous leaders, leaders of principle, leaders of self-awareness, leaders who understand that we find our true power, a real sense of abiding satisfaction, and our destiny in becoming leaders that are serving a purpose greater than ourselves, right? The public servants is what we talk about when we talk about government officials. And we are craning our necks and parched in the desert for those people right now at the national level. I think one of the most important messages of the book is that in times of crisis, national crisis, political crisis, emotional crisis, moral, ethical crisis, because the chapters 4 and chapter 3, which deal with Frederick Douglass and slavery and Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, both of those are stories about moral crises and, people that have gone off the rails in terms of their truest principles and their sense of decency. And how do leaders in those moments discover, right, their stronger selves? How do they call that forth in other people? How do they begin with an inchoate sense of purpose and an idea about where they should head, and then clarify and refine and distill and articulate and then bring other people along with them? Margaret Mead, the American anthropologist, once said, "Never doubt the ability of a group of concerned citizens to change the world. Indeed, nothing else ever has." And what several of the stories in this book demonstrate beyond doubt is the powerful truth of that statement, that these are individuals who, against all odds, with the help of other people, a group of concerned citizens, and with their own sheer grit and resilience and commitment to getting better and emotional awareness, move the boulder of goodness forward appreciably and to the benefit of all kinds of other people.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Harvard historian Nancy Kane, author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. What's really unique about your approach here is what I would call this book an instructional biography. I've read plenty of biographies, and most of them, frankly, are too long for my reading because I just have to read too many books in the course of a year. But your book has five great biographies in it. But what you've done is insert into each biography periodically as you're telling the narrative, as you're telling their story, the takeaways, what we get from that. And yeah. I just thought that was a really interesting approach that, you know, might be a little on the textbook side, but your book is nothing like a textbook, that's for sure.
No, it's a popular book, right? And the wonderful thing about the five stories is you can start anywhere, right? You can.
That's right. And I did, by the way.
Right. I know a number of people said, I wanted to start with Bonhoeffer. I always wanted to know about Rachel Carson and the launch of the environmental movement. You can start anywhere. And the reason I love the term instructional biography. I didn't set out to do that. What I set out to do was to uncover their stories. And, you know, we work inductively. We're like magpies historians. We're gathering these little bits, you know, branches and thread and paper and trying to build a nest of what happened in the past. And as I'm piecing together the story, pulling the bits out of intimate letters or diaries or government reports or whatever, I'm discovering that there's so much relevance in what these people learned for all kinds of folks, whether you're leading a family or a school principal trying to keep the library open longer, or you're a police chief facing budget cuts and, you know, a confused community, or you're a senator, or you're thinking about running for office, or a young person trying to start a movement. I thought no matter what you're trying to lead, because we're all leading something in some group of people, I thought they're just these little diamonds in the rough that these people learned. Why don't I offer them up? And that comes out, that idea, the germ of that comes from all those years of teaching in the unusual position that I'm in, which is a historian at HBS. So rather than uncover these great, long, very, very detailed stories of lives, I have short, but I hope very, again, to the point stories of these lives that I believe are very much the historical truth. I know they are. And then I've highlighted what are the things that people today can get for themselves and their lives out of the stories. And again, that comes from all those years of teaching executives or teaching MBAs or teaching our Kennedy School students at our government school how to understand the past and use it as they march along their own path.
Well, I can't begin in this brief interview to cover all of the lessons that one can take away from this book, whether it's the power of resilience, the importance of writing well, seeing the big picture, leading from humanity, cultivating emotional awareness. And maybe you and I will get to these by the end of 30 minutes, but I want to start with the one that just knocked me off of my chair as I'm reading this, and that's the absolutely insurmountable odds facing these five people in very different ways. And I thought I knew something about all five of these people. I learned a great deal I didn't know. Let's just start with Rachel Carson. I mean, we all know Silent Spring. We all know that she was the leader of the environmental movement. What I did not know is the incredible physical odds she had to confront in order to write this book and be the leader of the movement she was.
Right. So I mean, I'm not the first person by any means to piece together the amazing story of the grace and the bravery and the care and the kindness. I mean, her story is such a story in many ways of tenderness and of resilience of Rachel Carson. But what I have put together in I think in a new way with some new insights is thinking of her as a leader who was forged in her battle not only to finish Silent Spring, which from the time it was known that she was writing about the dangers of DDT and other pesticides, relatively new pesticides in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, there were all kinds of threats by very established interests from chemical companies to the United States Department of Agriculture made against her. So from the moment she's working on this, she's in relatively, you know, if not dangerous, somewhat perilous territory. It is made much more perilous, and the odds go up just monumentally when in the late 1960s, she's diagnosed with metastasizing cancer. And she knows after a second opinion that she is not likely to live very long. And so at one fundamental level, the story of her trying to finish this book and do it right, do her homework, get the story right, piece together things that haven't been pieced together, right? Write a pragmatic and majestic and in some ways transcendent analysis of not only the fragile and tough web of life that sustains us all, but of man's, if you will, arrogance or short-sightedness in pushing blindly into a magnitude of use that is dangerous for him and for the rest of the web of life. That work has this huge other piece, which is she's trying to do it, and she's trying to fight back the monster of cancer. And so there are many, many moments in the story when she wants to give up, and she's so scared. She's scared because she doesn't know how much time she has left. She doesn't know what form the cancer will take next. And I say at one point, this is the isolation that comes with knowing that you may die, or with the prospect of dying. And that is a huge piece of the world that she lives in internally as she's trying to finish this book. And I say at the same time that the bravery she kept summoning up and strengthening as she did this, I think made her bolder, made her more resilient in writing the book, and made her work harder to make sure she got the story right. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not sure Silent Spring could have changed the world in such important ways as it did from almost as soon as it was published if in some ways she hadn't forged herself into the kind of brave and yet quiet and gentle person that she was as she finished it.
Well, when I said insurmountable odds, the other case study here that comes to mind is Ernest Shackleton. I must admit, the guy I knew the least about among your five biographies, but I have never in my life seen so many things thrown in the way of success and movement forward than what that guy was dealt with. And yet, at the end of it all, you can maybe sum it up for us. He gets out of this thing with all of his men alive.
Right. So the kernel of the story for your listeners that don't know this, and once you start, you won't put this one down, right? It's a great adventure story in the book, is the story of an Antarctic explorer who finds his ship stuck in early 1915, just caught in a vise of icebergs, and eventually the icebergs crush the ship off the coast of Antarctica. It floats in the currents in its vise for a few months, crushes it, the ship goes down, and he is left in late 1915 with 27 men, three 20-foot rowboats, a bunch of canned goods, and basically nothing else in terms of resources to somehow get these guys off the floating berg and safely home to civilization. Without internal dissension, doubt, despair, or the weather or starvation killing them first. And so the chapter is the story of how he does that, how he leads them to ultimate safety, how he accomplishes this mission, which he never expected to have because he didn't expect this to happen, and how he keeps surmounting what, again, seem like obstacles or mountains that no one else could get over. And he does it completely from the inside out. So the story is very greatly dependent on how Shackleton talks to himself, right, manages himself, keeps his own worst fears hidden from the men except for one very trusted first mate, because if they think he's scared and they think he doubts himself, they'll start doubting. And nothing kills, you know, a team's ability to function effectively like internal doubt and dissension. So it's an incredible story. And it's, again, the backdrop is this, the perilous, dangerous circumstances of life right off the coast of Antarctica in 1915 and 1916.
Your biographies of Bonhoeffer and Frederick Douglass, they both had one common theme, where these were two gentlemen that could have easily escaped their eventual fate, and they chose to come back. Tell those two stories.
So each of these stories opens, the biographies opens with the leader, the protagonist, in a great personal crisis. So in each of the cases, Biography 3 and Biography 4, Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave and abolitionist, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the least well-known perhaps to your American listeners, a clergyman who became a very active member in the resistance, ultimately part of a conspiracy within the Nazi government to assassinate Hitler and overthrow the Third Reich. Each of these men get a chance at a moment when the situation is very, very hot, very dangerous for them. In the case of Frederick Douglass, he's a public celebrity because his first autobiography is a bestseller and his owner's trying to recapture him. Other people want to kill him in 1845, and his friends spirit him away to England to safety, where he becomes a celebrity of a different kind and very, you know, feted and worshipped and very, very important actor in the English abolition movement. And then Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who in 1939 is spirited away out of Germany because he's on the SS and the Gestapo watch list, and he's a target his friends fear for imprisonment and possibly execution, because he's already been an active member of the clerical resistance to Hitler. And in each case, each of the men, for almost the same reasons, although completely independent of each other, decide Douglas decides, I can't stay in England. Bonhoeffer decides, I can't stay in New York. I have to go back into the fray, into the danger, because that's where I will join the people I must work with to accomplish my mission. So both these men turn their backs on lives of relative ease and safety to literally go right back to ground zero and say, I'm rolling up my sleeve, I'm linking arms with my brethren and my sisters, and we're going to work. And it's fascinating. And they're scared. They're each scared. And they each decide to do it and move into the fear. And so that's where those stories open.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Nancy Kane, author of Forged in Crisis, which profiles five extraordinary leaders through history and the challenges they faced. What really impressed me about the Frederick Douglass situation was what a celebrity he was in England. I really had not read that before and didn't quite understand how far along England was in the area of race relations. Here's a guy who's a slave back in his own country, fearing for his life every time he sets out because people do know who he is. And then he goes to England and this guy's like a movie star.
Right. He's like a movie star. He's paid well. He writes home to William Lloyd Garrison, the very most famous abolitionist of his time. He writes, you know, this is for the first time in my life, no one, I'm not treated as someone who has black skin. I'm not treated as an inferior because my skin is black. I mean, it's quite astounding. I mean, England was in a very, very different place morally and politically and socially, and had a much more advanced abolition movement than the United States. And then, interestingly, those same people, and this is why it's an allure for Douglass to stay, wanted to turn their energies and Douglass's talents to work on trying to affect the situation of slavery in the United States, right, from England. Mm-hmm. And he says, as good as this is, I need to go back to where the real action is. And he does, and he makes, not easily, not neatly, it's messy, this is messy, difficult work that has lots and lots of, you know, rollbacks and switchbacks and false starts and wrong turns. Messily, he does make a tremendous difference. Mm-hmm. In fact, I suggest in both the Lincoln chapter and the Douglass chapter, that without the groundwork, the work on the ground that Douglass does among northern whites, Lincoln would never have had the political capital he needed by 1862 to actually promulgate the Emancipation Proclamation.
I have to admit that the last biography of Year Five that I read was Lincoln. I used to live in Springfield, Illinois. I feel like I've been through Lincoln's home more often than Lincoln lived there. Taking friends and relatives through it over the years. So I waited on that one, but I was really fascinated the way you closed the chapters on Lincoln by alluding to the more negative tones that some recent Lincoln research and publications have uncovered or decided to focus on. And you suggest that we look at Lincoln, like really all of these people, in a larger context.
We do. I mean, I think we're never going to be finished as a people with Mr. Lincoln. I mean, he stood at the head of the country at such a pivotal time, right? A time of great divide and toxicity and, you know, extraordinary division, so extraordinary, you know, that brothers went to war against brothers, right? I mean, there were a couple of families at Gettysburg where brothers were fighting on the same battlefield against each other. I mean, extraordinary. So this was another moment of extraordinary division about, again, an incredibly relevant issue, race, and its place in the American polity. And here's a man who not only led the nation through it, kept it united, but in the midst of it made an incredible decision that was absolutely, you know, the right one, the higher road choice, but still one that hadn't been made before, which is we're going to fight this war to end slavery and we're going to restore America to its animating promise. And then with a lot of the legwork or groundwork, the groundwork he laid the groundwork for the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And so Lincoln stands in many, many ways for the better angels of our nature as a people, the better angels of our nature. Who are we meant to be when we are together, our best selves as citizens and as Americans? And I think that will remain true for many generations, and that in that place, Lincoln and how he lived and how he became the leader he was, because he certainly was a very different man when he was assassinated in 1865 than he was when he entered the White House. Stronger, bolder, wiser, right? Much more generous, right? Much more forbearing. How do each generation, succeeding generations, grapple with and get right with Lincoln will be a question for the ages for Americans.
Well, in terms of the growth and development of an individual, if you just look at the way you characterized and the way every bio that's ever been done on Lincoln characterizes his early views on race and then the way that progresses through his life, I mean, there's a lesson there that just because you grow up stuck in looking at life one way doesn't mean you can't grow and develop and find other ways of looking at an issue like race.
Absolutely. And this is, again, I mean, one of the wonderful gifts that these people, these my subjects, gave me was to help me show, and this is why I say at the very end of the conclusion that leading with your humanity is so important, they revealed their humanity to me. So Lincoln did not come out of his mother's womb as the great emancipator, right? And he didn't come out of his mother's womb as the author of the Gettysburg Address or the second inaugural, right? This is a person who grew up partly in Kentucky and lived in Illinois, and I'm from Illinois as well. Bob, I spent a lot of time in Springfield and from Bloomington, Illinois.
Oh, sure.
Right? But downstate Illinois in the 19th century was a place where there were a lot of former slaveholders. Mm-hmm. And downstate was very different than Chicago. And so here's a person who had not spent much time with black Americans who comes to know more and more black Americans, including Frederick Douglass. And over the course of not only his presidency, but the 1850s and then very much into his presidency, particularly when he learns a great deal about the bravery of black soldiers fighting for the Union cause, slowly but very consistently changes his thinking, evolves. He evolves. And so there's a lesson about our own humanity in Lincoln's evolution that I think is important for people to take in as they wish.
What role does failure play in each of these lives, or at least some of them?
Well, let's talk about Lincoln again, because one of the ways in which I think I have something new to offer about Lincoln, one of the most written about people in, you know, in English, is, and I say this with a good hunk of humility, is what he made of the mileage he had with failure. He had a lot of mileage with failure. He had not only this, where he'd lost his mother when he was very young, he grappled with what today we'd call chronic depression, but what he would call the hypo or melancholy all his life. He lost far more elections than he won ultimately, certainly the big elections. He often felt like he was a complete failure professionally. He worried about his ability to be a good father and a good husband. And certainly at many, many moments during the presidency, he thought he was faced with certain failure ahead in his ability to keep the Union together. And yet, one of the really interesting roles that failure plays for each of these people is that as they learn not in each instance, one by one, not to give up, sometimes by a hair's breadth, just by a tiny fine line, not to give up, to take the next small step toward the mission, even though they feel so disappointed or despairing. Over time, as their familiarity with failure grows, so do their muscles of resilience, their muscles of determination, their muscles to do the hard right thing. And I argue that the mileage of failure over time makes these people stronger, not only more resilient, more adaptive. Right, more able to navigate through the next failure because they have some real experience in their belt, on their odometer, with great disappointment. And that's really important.
When we think of leaders, we oftentimes think of somebody who's quick to the draw, men and women of action. And yet there's a couple of messages in your book across the lives of these leaders that are about the importance of leaders taking time to reflect. The solitary moments, slow down, forbear reacting in the immediacy of a particular moment. You said something like that in the book, I think.
I write that in a number of instances. Lincoln's the great practitioner of this. Do nothing when the emotional stakes are high. Wait. Mm-hmm. Just do nothing. Just have enough emotional discipline to do nothing. Don't hit tweet. Don't hit post. Don't hit send. Don't mail the letter in Lincoln's case that has all your anger in it. Just wait.
We can all learn
just
about
breathe
that.
Breathe and think. And take stock, but don't act in the heat of the moment. They all learn this, and they practice it, and it serves them very, very well. That's an incredibly important lesson for our white-hot moment when we're all doing a lot of damage by reacting immediately.
Well, that's a fitting conclusion to our time here today, Nancy. I want to thank you so much for writing the book, for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times, by Nancy Kane, professor at the Harvard Business School. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It was a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Nancy Kane. Next week, Tara Westover, author of the memoir Educated. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sienna Madrid. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.